Welcome to 2024 and Season 5 of the Religion Podcast, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion.
Hello, Reverend T.
How about it, Rabbi L? So we doing initials now? What's up with that?
Or Dr. Dreidel, as I, my nom de, is it a nom de plume or is it a nom de guerre? What's the difference? Plume is writing. What's nom de guerre?
War. Your war name.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, no, it's not my war name.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Your battle title. Wait, are you a doctor
you
now?
Coffee.
Do you have a doctorate of ministry?
No, but if I'm alive in 7 years, I will.
Have you started it?
No. So we call it the I'm Still Alive degree. If in Reform, at our seminary, Hebrew Union College, if you've been ordained for 25 years, at that 25th year, you go to a ceremony. Well, not everyone goes, but you're invited to a ceremony on the Cincinnati campus to receive an honorary doctorate. And you know what? It's funny. I'm not sure what that doctorate is. I should know. I'm not sure that it's ministry.
Survival.
But it is an honorary doctorate. But it's not, you know, as my wife loves to remind me, it is not an actual doctorate.
Oh my goodness! Well, Rabbi Eric, we have our first season five out. You know, it's out there. Israel,
it's
Palestine.
Out.
That's right. And I don't know if you noticed, but as a result of that podcast, we have now hit 5,000 downloads total.
Wow! I did not yet notice that. That's wonderful.
Yes.
Hopefully the number doesn't go precipitously down following that episode.
Right.
But yes.
No.
Well, today's I think is a less sensitive subject, although certainly, you know, interesting to both of us and stimulating, but not as politically charged anyhow.
Agreed. Yeah, it's this one. It could be. It's not politically charged, but it could be really charged for some people.
Oh, for sure.
We'll try
for
to
sure. Well, let's
out.
Get into it.
Sure. We had an email suggestion for a topic from a Todd who wrote to us, the two of us. And the question, the way he says it is, my suggestion concerns the question of excommunication in Judaism and Christianity. His email then explains how he was working with some folks and they were trying to understand both the legal and the religious and the theological implications of when a religious order gets to decide who is in or who is out, who has power to decide who is in or out, what it looks like to keep and hold and have that power and to make internal decisions about the religious order versus legal decisions in the United States. So it all boiled down to where do Judaism and Christianity specifically stand on excommunication? And the way I interpret this is also where do we stand on how do we define and decide who holds power in meaning the power to decide things and change things and move things in our direction or leadership or property or budgets. And he, you could sense in his longer email, there was some ache for all the parties involved and there was some confusion about how religious versus legal things overlap. So that's what's before us. How do religious orders decide who's in and who's out and what does it take to be removed from one of our religious orders?
Sure. And shout out to Todd, who's a congregant and friend here in Athens. So it's interesting because in Judaism, there's really no, it's especially in modern Judaism, there's no, like the word excommunication doesn't exist. There is a Hebrew word, harem, which is more of like a imposed exile of sorts. But if you're, you know, we've talked about what it means to be halakhically Jewish, meaning Jewish by law, by Jewish law, which is being born to a Jewish mother or converting. And you, there's nothing that one could do, or on the flip side, you know, there's not a rule that someone could not follow that would make someone not Jewish. Now, the famous case that's sometimes pointed to is the philosopher Spinoza was, you know, again, people use the word excommunicated, but even that was more of a, he was expelled from his community as a leader. And, you know, this was before the internet, before social media. So to be expelled by one's particular community was in essence being excommunicated because, you know, that's where you were known. You know, there was no social media where you could move to another community and everyone would know who you were. But the question of who decides, who has power, I think that has ramifications in religion beyond the question of, you know, does someone get to decide whether or not you remain Jewish or not? But we can get into that. I'm curious how you, because excommunication does exist as a word in Christianity. So I'm curious how you respond to that.
Yeah, it was a created word in the ancient church. It's really different now. I guess we're going to have to like try to organize this thought so we can address different facets of it. One, there's the, what does it take to be considered a Jew or a Christian? That's one level of the conversation. And then what does it take as a Jew or Christian to be included in a specific Jewish or Christian community? That's a different conversation. And then what does it take inside that specific community to be lifted up as a leader of that, in that specific community with unique authority and responsibility and accountability? So I see his question, we probably need to address all three layers and what it looks like to move in or through each one of those membranes, semi-permeable membranes. Is that a fair way to start it?
Maybe. I haven't had enough coffee yet, so I'm just going to follow what you say. But even when we got this email, I mean, we've had it for a while. So Todd, hopefully you're still with us, and everybody else. One of the things I thought of, and maybe it's because I very recently talked about this with a colleague, is one thing that I do decide in terms of the who's in, who's out. And really, in many ways, the only thing that I decide is conversion. So if one is not Jewish, yes, they could see another rabbi, but in other words, in terms of my congregation, in terms of me being involved, I am the gatekeeper. And I don't say this as a point of pride. This is one of the aspects of the rabbinate that is sometimes really painful. I take it very seriously, you know, converting someone. It's kind of a covenantal relationship between me and the conversion prospect, or the prospective convert rather. And there have been times where I felt that someone is not right for conversion or right at the current time that they approach me. And that is a very hard thing to tell someone, especially in a place where there's not a ton of other rabbis that they can go see.
And in that situation, you are defining whether or not someone enters the grand Judaism. You're not only defining whether or not they enter your community, but you are defining whether or not you as a leader consider them Jewish.
Yes and no. And I say yes and no because whereas I absolutely, and I'm very clear with people, I said, you know, I am a certain brand of rabbi, just as you're a certain brand of Christian, right? I mean, I represent a liberal denomination and it's important to understand what Reformed Judaism is. And you will be part of Am Yisrael, the larger community of Israel, the peoplehood of Israel, even if not everyone in that peoplehood accepts you as a Jew because of me. So that's why I say yes and no. But yes, I'm converting someone to Judaism. So there have been instances, and I've known about this in advance, of course, where someone will come to me saying, you know, I'm a grad student, I'm a PhD student, and I'm going to be leaving Athens in 2 years, but I want to start this process. If the person is right, I'm not going to say no simply because they're not going to be a member of quote unquote my community. Uh-huh. They'll be a member somewhere else and give, you know, and hopefully give strength to the Jewish people elsewhere. So the short answer is yes, but the caveat there is important for me.
Okay. So it does become, you leave some flexibility that a person may or may not be Jewish, regardless of what you say, but your line is, are you Jewish in such a way that you easily fit well or obviously fit well into our way of practicing Jewish community?
100%. And that has to be defined by them too. That can't only, like, in other words, someone needs to be, like, if someone wanted to live a halakhic lifestyle, of keeping Jewish law to an extent that I would deem not compatible with Reform Judaism, which there's a lot of slipperiness there. But I would suggest maybe finding a more traditionally minded rabbi. So even though they're not converting to, you know, when someone converts, they don't convert to a denomination, you convert to Judaism. But it wouldn't make sense for them to work with me because they would need to be coming to our services and our programs and feeling comfortable with our way, our brand, right? So if that wasn't the case, a flip side of the question for me, which isn't theological in the slightest, but it involves the opposite of kicking someone out. And so we just are in the finishing processes of having what we're calling a congregational brit. So a lot of people know the word bris, right? Traditionally when boys are 8 years old, they have a bris. So a brit is a covenant. And so we're having members of the congregation and we're retroact, it's going to be not grandfathered in. So when members submit their dues for the following fiscal year, they'll sign this. That it's basically a brit talking about ethical behavior in the congregation. And if it's abrogated seriously, it could result in someone being asked, you know what, you're not a great fit here. This isn't the right place for you. Now, I do not think that that is going to happen. This isn't like, oh, someone, you know, said something that hurt someone's feelings, therefore we're kicking them out. Like, this is the most, we're talking about egregious things that are toxic and harmful that, you know, God forbid, happen. But again, that's not about the religion. That's about the particularity of an organization. So in the same sense.
Let's keep those lines clean here, Eric. Let's,
yeah.
What does it mean to be Jewish? What does it mean to be a member of a congregation? And then what does it mean to be a leader with responsibility and authority?
I want to say one more thing and then I'm going to stop talking. So I promise. So Joel's like, thank God. And this is without coffee, Joel. So one thing that my denomination, the Reform Movement, takes very seriously speaking of ethics, is the ethics of its leaders, its clergy. I'm a member of what's called the CCAR, Central Conference of American Rabbis, and we are bound by an ethical covenant. And there's an ethics committee that is run by our movement that does training in impartiality and, you know, how to effectively adjudicate matters that involve ethical misconduct. And, you know, Judaism takes very seriously, as we've talked about, this concept of tshuva, of repair and repentance. And so, as does the ethical process. So God forbid, if I do something wrong, I'm not automatically like disbarred. There might be a process of healing that I can do. But let's pretend, again, God forbid, I do the most egregious thing possible. Okay? I am still a rabbi. No one can take that away. But what they can take away is essentially my ability to serve as a rabbi, as a reform rabbi. So like, I could get, you know, I could, of course, get fired. I could be deemed by the reform movement. I could be on a list of, you know, here are rabbis that have committed ethical transgressions. And if someone's found guilty, it is allowed to say what that transgression is without specifics, right? So like if it's sexual misconduct, it'll say something like that. If it's financial mismanagement or stealing, it'll say that. And then congregations, when they hire rabbis, see that list. And God willing, don't look at anyone on it, right? So again, that's more of a practical approach to this question as opposed to the, you know, in kind of a philosophical, they're no longer Jewish, they're no longer a leader. Well, they are no longer a leader, but again, from a more much more practical standpoint than a, you are not Jewish anymore, you are not a rabbi anymore.
So what we're doing is, like, and listeners, you're feeling this, I'm sure. We are throwing out a lot of gray into the world. And so what I'm trying to do is imagine the 2x3 matrices. What does it take to be named a member of Christianity or Judaism, regardless of which community you're in? What does it take to be a member of a particular Christian or Jewish community? And when, what does it take to be a leader in a particular Christian or Jewish community or set of communities? And then who or how can one be excommunicated out of that box to a different box or totally out of the column? Well, what Eric was just telling us is he's in the third box, say. He's a set leader in a particular type of Jewish community. And he could make a mistake where that particular Jewish community, the Reform Council of Rabbis or whatever, says, nope, you can no longer practice in this kind of rabbinate. But another Jewish community could still call him, hire him, pay him, and follow his lead. And it wouldn't affect whether or not he was considered Jewish or even a rabbi. It would just affect the particular community in which he practiced. How am I doing, Eric? Is all that clean and crisp? You haven't been excommunicated from anything except leadership in a particular community.
And then I'm sorry, Joel, I missed the first part. If what happens, what's the prefix of that?
Yeah, if you make some mistake, right? People over you who have authority over you, that council.
Oh, yeah, as long as it's not deemed an ethical mistake. Look, you know, we've talked about this before. I'm hired, the way in Reform Judaism, the way clergy are hired is the way people are hired at any other, what I'll call normal job, right? So it is a contract. So, you know, not a lot of people have contracts. But I get evaluated every year, and the congregation at the end of my contract, and you know this because you and I, we always talk about it as, you know, you and I are both up for kind of renewal at our places. The congregation decides whether they want me to continue as their rabbi. And they don't need any other reason. Like, they could be like, I don't like him. I don't want, so, you know, people can use that vote however they want to. Mm-hmm. But yes, that doesn't make me not a rabbi. That just means I'm not the rabbi of that particular congregation.
Right. Okay. So let's, from the bottom up, I'm going to see if I can start to, because what the question is how is somebody removed against their will from their standing in a religious order? And that's a big question. And it's sometimes it's called excommunication, but that can mean a pope or a rabbi or a priest is excommunicated out of their congregation or out of their order. And or it can mean a member or another leader is removed from a community. But the question then is, are they still Jewish or are they still Christian, even if removed from that community? And almost always, I think almost all religions say, sure. We're not making a statement as to whether or not this person is still Jewish or Christian. We are making the statement that they are not a welcome participant in this particular religious community because of their actions or their statements or their beliefs or something. And usually, in almost every religious, Christian or Judaism, there is some kind of manual or constitution or policy book or, you know, standards, and it lays that out. And those standards are can be really old and modified for hundreds and hundreds of times, as old as the Constitution of the United States, or thousands of years old, where we have wisdom and lessons that say, hey, if you have a Jewish member or a Christian member of a particular community and they do something like this, here is the process for properly adjudicating whether or not they are allowed to stay in the community and have the full rights and powers of a member of that community, which may mean vote. Say, it's time to vote for whether or not Rabbi Eric is still our rabbi. Does that individual person have the right to speak to that motion that we keep Eric or fire Eric? Does that person get a vote when it's time to say, all in favor, aye, all opposed, nay? Those kind of moments are, almost every religious order has some kind of constitutional defined policy and procedure that says who and how to decide if a person is a member of that congregation, corporation, synagogue, gathering. And people can, because that policy or procedure exists, it always defines a path to remove access to speaking and voting and full rights and access of membership. Almost never do any of those processes across any Christian sect, or I would assume any way of practicing Judaism, remove the person from being a child of God slash Jew or Christian. But the excommunication is only from the powers they have in a community or from the community as a whole, if the action is egregious enough. So I don't think you and I have a way to excommunicate somebody out of our religion as a whole. I think we only have a way to remove them from leadership, but they stay in a community, or to remove them from the community itself. Is that
And fair? I would say that's correct. Yes, but not entirely, because I don't have that power.
Sure. I don't mean like you and me as religious leaders have that power. We are bound by that constitution, policy, procedure,
right?
The like, community so standards.
So we just, so funny that we're talking about this today, because at our last, you know, again, with this congregational breed, we had a board meeting. At our board meeting last month, we were talking about what if a board member who possibly has access to funds and checkbooks and things does something or is accused of something, they need to, you know, we absolutely want and need, you know, a due process for that, to kind of figure out what happened. But at the same time, like, we need to keep our checkbook safe, right? So the board needs flexibility in kind of being able to quickly say, okay, this person as of right now is, you know, suspended from being able to look at our books. But there needs to be something down the road that's a little more thoughtful with proper due process also.
And y'all have those policies and procedures in place already. If not inside your personal congregation, you have in the Reform Order of Judaism everywhere, you have guidance and guidelines and policies and procedures that are recommended or suggested, or that you may be constitutionally bound to. I don't know.
Well, and this, no, it's per congregation. So like that, that's just an interesting like tidbit. Each congregation is kind of its own thing in that regard. But one thing I will say, and, you know, as I keep mentioning, we're finalizing this breach, this covenant now. This is something that our movement is suggesting that congregations do. And it's kind of like the thing right now. So I have a lot of colleagues who are in a similar process, or maybe did this last year, or maybe you're starting to do this next year. Because we should hold ourselves as not just leaders, but congregants to a certain standard of behavior. And, you know, I'll say too, in 18 years now of being a rabbi, one person was kind of kicked out of the community, and it wasn't here. It was in my former congregation, and with very, you know, there was some severe toxic behavior going on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this isn't something that, like, you know, happens regularly. It's in circumstances where the congregation, where the behavior or the action is so harmful that there's no other action that could be done.
Let me see if I can get go through the Christian vein here for a bit. So, Christian churches define being a Christian differently. Dadgummit, right? It's really weird to me that we do that, but we do. And unfortunately, a lot of Christian churches define being a Christian as whatever it is that makes you Christian in their particular community. So not every Christian community honors the Christianity of each other. That doesn't surprise
totally.
You, but it,
no,
you know, it's a sad thing in a way to me. So the Presbyterian Church USA, through the denomination or sect through which I practice, we say that there are two very, very basic requirements that say to us, regardless of where or when or how it happened, that define you as a Christian. One is, did some community of faith affirm faith on your behalf with you, you know, in some way? Did parents and a community, were you baptized? Did water touch you at some point under the name of Creator Christ and Consoler, Father, Son, Holy Spirit? And then at some point, did you, as a what we call a confirmand, maybe a teenager, did you step forward and say with your own spirit yes to similar questions? So we call it baptism and affirmation of faith. And in the Presbyterian Church USA, we don't really care how much water was used. We don't care what kind of water. We don't care if you were dunked or sprinkled or poured over. We don't care. Was water involved? Was there a triune formula involved? And did your community and you kind of agree that you are renouncing evil and sin and its powers in the world? You sense them in you as well as the world. You are turning your eyes and attention towards Jesus of Nazareth as his guide through the maze before you, and you're willing to walk this path all the way to the end. And if those two things, baptism and affirmation, have happened, you're a Christian, period, for us. We don't care if it was Methodist or Moravian. We don't care.
But let me ask you a question,
yep,
though. Have you ever had a case where someone – do you call that conversion when someone goes through that process?
No, we just call it baptism and affirmation of faith.
Okay, so that's not my question.
A lot of Christians do, right? They call it being converted, yes.
Got it. But that's not my question. What my question is, have you ever had the experience – where someone comes to, I'm going to use the word conversion just as a shorthand, where someone had converted to Christianity and it's not the way you would have done it, right?
No. Not in a minor way,
but in a significant way, the process that they went through in some fashion wasn't kind of the way you think is important.
No.
Would you still accept them?
And that's the weird thing about Presbyterian Church USA. We are freakishly inclusive of anybody that attempted to be Christian in any way that included water baptism and some affirmation. And if the questions were different, or the amount of water was different, or the pastor was a sexual predator when he baptized you, none of that matters to us. Now, a lot of Christian sects and practices, it matters. They will not include you if you were baptized as an infant. They make you be baptized again. They will not include you if you were only sprinkled with water. They dunk you and they make you be fully immersed. They will not count the questions of affirmation that you were asked at a Methodist church in your confirmation process because they're a conservative Baptist, and therefore they make you say their questions of affirmation again. And a lot of Christianity, most of Christianity practices, you are a Christian if you abide by their definition of Christian.
Sure.
Now, so and we don't, and let me ask you another question. A lot do.
Is that, is what you just said, the fact that you accept anyone who tried going through the process, is that, are you obligated to do that, or is that your personal theological choice?
Both. It our Constitution defines our policies and procedures out of our theology. So, and our theology kind of says God knows who the Christians are. We don't. We have little pointers that kind of suggest who is and who isn't, or who may be or who may not be. But those, what we do as Christians, the practices that we attempt to say we are or are not under the umbrella of Christianity, those practices are sinful too. They're flawed with our inherent biases and sins also. So they can't be holy. So they can't make somebody Christian, even if we do them to our best or even if we half-ass do them. They don't make somebody Christian or unmake somebody Christian. So we don't really know. But what, therefore, our theology is, we're not going to judge the practice of our brother and sister Christians because they did it weirdly or differently or whatever. We're just going to say yes to it and trust God's got them.
So that, I would say in Reformed Judaism, that is very similar. That's a very similar approach. But I think it's more of a, it sounds like it's more of a tension than it is for you. So I'll give some examples. There are some rabbis who won't convert someone into an interfaith relationship. So in other words, let's say that you and I are married, Joel. Forget that we're clergy.
Got it.
You and I are married. Yep. Neither of us are Jewish, right? And I want to be Jewish. And I meet with the rabbi, a rabbi, to convert to Judaism. They would essentially, if they are converting me to Judaism, they're essentially converting me into an interfaith relationship. And that, and even for rabbis that kind of, you know, accept interfaith partnerships and all those things, there's discrepancy even there. And I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong. It just, it happens to be the case that there are, and I think with valid reasons. I personally don't follow this as a kind of a hard rule, but I get it and I respect it. But let's say that, I find a rabbi that converts me. We're in an interfaith marriage, and then we move. And we look at the Reform congregation, and I meet with the rabbi. Oh, who converted you? And, or, you know, tell me about your conversion process. And I tell them, and they think to themselves, oh, I wouldn't have converted this guy. Right?
Uh-huh.
But in almost every circumstance that I can think of, they are still thought of as Jewish. But that's not by fiat. That is kind of a, what I would say, just an unwritten, you know, what I might call respect for our colleagues, or just respect for Am Yisrael, in the sense of, it's like, you know, when someone, this goes back to the previous conversation a few minutes ago, if someone converts with me, again, like, they're not obligated to live in Athens, Georgia the rest of their life. And what? That means they might be subject to have to convert again. Now, that being said, when someone does convert with me, I tell everyone, because I think I'm intellectually kind of obligated to, that this conversion will not be recognized by some sects of Judaism. I can say with pretty much full confidence that it'll absolutely be recognized in any Reform and probably conservative congregation, you know. But again, if the person wanted to move to Israel and live an Orthodox lifestyle, probably not. They'd probably have to go through some sort of conversion again.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely been circumstances where I've talked with other colleagues, and we've talked about, you know, congregants that were kind of grandfathered in as converts. And it's like, huh, you know, I don't know that I would have done that. It's an interesting tension for sure, but at the end of the day, it's too painful for all involved to say, well, no, that conversion doesn't work for me, even if it's not the way that I would have done it.
Fair. And a lot of our responses here have been, we're trying to figure out where the boundaries are and what it takes to go across the boundary. So you keep referring to conversion. That is entering a community. The question we were really asked is, what does it take to kick somebody back yes. across that line? So that's it. It's the same line in a way. And we try to be consistent, I'm sure, as denominations or theologies or religions or sects, but that wherever that line is, the entry process, which you've called conversion a few times, is really different from the exit process or excommunication or unconversion.
Well, I'll tell you, so this just popped in my mind. It is, you know, a thought experiment that I used for years. It's not as timely anymore. Is could oh, now I can't think of his name. Who's the guy that with the Ponzi scheme that like screwed?
Yeah, we know who you're talking about. Keep going. When it'll come to us.
Will it though?
Yeah, it's going to bother me.
So I because he was Jewish, and when it and I remember, especially during High Holiday time,
Madoff.
Kind of asked the question. Thank you, Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, because he made off with everybody else's money. Yeah.
Well done. Good mnemonic. Would I'm going to add that to my memory palace. Would he be allowed to worship with us?
To right? worship and, you with know, you?
Or to be a part of our community?
Okay. That's a different line.
Yeah, no, absolutely different. Absolutely different. And I would like to think the answer is yes, but I don't know that the answer is yes, right? And then, you know, more currently, I mean, he's not alive, but, you know.
Epstein, a harder question right? for you, because this one gets back to the point. If he was already a member of your congregation and then found guilty and prosecuted of everything he did, would you excommunicate him back across the line?
So here's what I think, and I think there'd be some, you know, we're implementing an ethics committee as part of this congregational breed, and so I'm both thankful that I don't make this decision by myself, and frankly, I shouldn't have that much power as an individual anyway. But I would say no, we don't excommunicate him. We don't put him in positions of leadership because he's not someone to be respected, but why shouldn't he be a member of the community? Now, if someone is a predator, that's a different story to me at first blush. That
Madoff was a predator.
Yeah.
He ruined people's lives permanently.
I need more time to think about it.
Okay. Well, that is the question that's kind of before us. So you're saying he wouldn't be a leader on the board for sure. He could still probably be a voting member with voice in meetings, and he could have his opinion heard, right? And so he could still be part of the election of the board or the president or the next
rabbi.
But like,
where do you draw – I guess the question too – so that is a super interesting question, and I'm not asking to be let off the hook on it. But, you know, would – what about adultery, right? Now,
yep.
Or, I mean, and so where does one draw the line where one is, with the distinction between member of the congregation, which has its own rights, like you can be a leader, you can be on committees, you have a vote, versus a guest. Now, well, I'll stop talking.
You're perfect. A little bit so here's our questioner's sake. In our Presbyterian Church USA constitution, the active member of a church, which is the format, it has a constitutional definition. And it is somebody who has at some point in their life been baptized and affirmed faith and was duly received by our governing board, the session, as an active member of this church. And what we say is the only requirements for being received by session of the congregation is that you were baptized in a firm faith at some point. If that was a really long time ago, we may ask you to reaffirm your faith. If you were never baptized, we will invite you to be baptized. But if you were at some point in your life as an infant or an adult baptized in some way, it counts. If you are an active member of another Christian congregation anywhere on the planet and you're moving from that one to us, that counts. If you went a long time with no active participation, then we ask you to reaffirm your faith as you enter us. And then an active member stays an active member of the church by participating in, quote, the work and worship of the congregation, close quote. And it is the board's, the session's, responsibility to measure and discern, are the two words, whether every individual is actively participating in the work and worship of the church. Now, in the Presbyterian Church, that and even
I'm writing that line down. I really like that.
Good. I can send you our constitution. We are freakishly theological and legalistic. So our constitution has a policy and procedure for everything, including all the ethical standards stuff that you're talking about.
You say it as if you're not a part of that. I mean, come on, that's you.
We have a constitution with four sections, the foundations, the worship, the government, and the discipline. And that last one, discipline, it is forms and procedures and outlines and definitions of what it takes to reprimand a leader or a member, and the process by which somebody is removed from leadership or membership. And then inside each congregation, there's a constant debate, are we being too hard or are we being too soft, right? But the policy and procedure is there, and each board or the people who have authority in each congregation have the responsibility to, inside the wider boundaries of those guidelines, go through the process. And you'll hear Presbyterian pastors teach sessions and administrative commissions and investigating committees, trust the process, trust the process, trust the process. Because part of the process is making the individuals involved in making this call have the conversation you and I are having. Was that the line? Is that the line? Is that where we want to draw the line? Are we sure?
That's
how
right.
Sure are we that he or she did
that? By the way, Joel, this is a little inside baseball here, but honest to God, please do send me that, because this will be very helpful to our board.
Sure,
If you could. Yeah, thank you.
It's very legalistic, and it's perfect for me because it helps me. It doesn't otherwise, people, what happens is members of the church attack church or congregational leaders when a person is in trouble and has made a mistake. And what the leader and the board need is a binding policy that they can point to and say, hey, I've had a youth director in a church where I was pastor. She was in her 30s, and she slept with a married man in the church who was also a member, and his wife was also a member. So, and she is responsible for youth. So the question becomes, all right, he just screwed up because he committed adultery. She screwed up because she's on staff and committed adultery. And the sweet wife is now in trouble because her house is being wrecked by a fellow member and a staff person. So what is our responsibility? And is excommunication a possibility for the member or the staff person? And using our discipline section, we instantly knew she's on paid administrative leave. She's no longer invited to lead anything at church. She still is invited to attend worship. And boy, that pissed people off. How dare you say she can attend worship? And what I said in return is, how dare you say that her sin is so great to not be invited into the presence of God, to lay it before God? So our door is open to sinners. We are not a house of clean people. We are a house of sinners who continue begging and hoping that God's forgiveness and grace and steadfast love is real. As for the member, we did not reprimand him or remove him, but we removed her from her leadership position her, but we did not remove her from her membership in the community.
No, that's an important distinction. Absolutely.
So there was no excommunication even for that that line. And now I'm responding to Todd from my one viewpoint. He needs to know Christian churches and sects excommunicate people all the time for all kinds of stuff, for being gay, right? For they will excommunicate a whole family for supporting a trans.
Now, when
child.
You say excommunicate, though,
yeah,
tell me exactly what you mean.
In their definition, not only are you no longer an active member of their congregation, you are sent out the door as a non-Christian in their mind, right?
Got it. No, that's excommunicate. Yeah, got it.
And
got
they
it.
Say to you, as they kick you out the door, you are not a Christian. And they may use terms like, you need to get right with God. You need to repent.
Yeah.
Right? You will need to go be healed of all of these things. And when you are, come back to us. But until you are clean enough, good enough, repentant enough, you are not Christian. Now, the thing where I have a hard time with that is Jesus went to the people in most trouble. Like when the religious communities of his time excommunicated lepers, right? Or bleeding women or whatever. They were excommunicated out of the community because those, maybe they were just blind or lame. They were considered to be too sinful to be included in the community. So they were excommunicated. And the way Jesus walked around is, no, no, sister, no, no, brother. They don't get to say whether you're a child of God. Right. And the community should have been helping you and serving you and loving you and taking care of you and even helping heal you, not kicking you out. So, but there are religious communities that will excommunicate you from their community and, in their opinion, from Christianity itself because of the way you were born or a belief. There are Christian communities that will expel you for questioning God. For questioning religious
leaders. Oh, yeah.
Leaders.
And speaking of conversion, one of the first things that I hear from many people who are leaving Christianity is exactly that, because that is a strong comparison, especially in Reform Judaism. But I would say in Judaism writ large is that ability, permission, not even permission, but expectation to question.
Yeah.
Which is, that's another
Midrash,
topic.
Baby. But, oh my gosh, we don't know. So let's argue it out for the rest of time. Right. That is the beauty of the relationship. And what some people, what some Christians do is no, we know. We've solved this. We have this. Here's your bullet point. Here's your quickie prayer. You say the sinner's prayer, the repenter's prayer. You get wet again because the first time you got wet, it obviously didn't work. And then you're a member of us. And the day that you don't agree with this stuff anymore, or the day you challenge one of our faith statements or creedal statements, you're out. There are Christian churches who do that. And I'm not going to, okay, y'all, don't fuss at me. But my Catholic brothers and sisters, do not let me participate in some of their rituals and sacraments because I'm not Catholic. And in that way of practicing Christianity, Catholics disagree a little. Am I Christian or not? And there are some sects of Orthodox Christianity or Catholic Christianity where I am not Christian, that the only Christians are Catholics or Orthodox. And there are other sects of Catholicism, where, yeah, I'm Christian, I'm just not Catholic. So why would I want to do sacraments the Catholic way? I do sacraments my own way, and that's fine. But note that, like, it's really hard to paint with a broad brush what Christian excommunication looks like. Sometimes it looks like burning witches at a stake, right? And sometimes it looks like you're really not a good fit here anymore because of that monstrous mistake you made. But we still love you and we still send you with blessings. You just can't vote anymore. You can never be a leader here. You're always welcome to worship with us, but you just don't have a voice and vote anymore in the direction that we're going. You can, and here's the other thing that Presbyterians do. We always give people a path back. Always. even if we send you, even if we push you back across a line, there is an invitation to come back through the line. And most of the ability to come back through is on you. We predefine your steps for you to come back through, and we give it to you.
But you don't. You wouldn't hire that person back as a youth advisor, right?
You can have. There was another church that I knew of where two associate pastors, both married, male and female, on the same staff, had an affair with each other. Right? So, oh my gosh, you have a multi-staff church where an older male and a younger female, both married, end up having an affair with each other. The male did what is called renouncing jurisdiction of the church. He says, you have no power over me. So he was excommunicated from his ordination and from his access to the community and the whole PCUSA communities. Even as he did that, he was given a path for reentry. We can't strip him of his ordination. We can only strip him of his ability to be installed and practice ministry. So we gave him a path. Here is your path for reconciliation. You must submit to blank. You must do this. You must do this. Must do this. And if so, you could be installed again in some Presbyterian church if they so wish to call you.
Oh, in some Presbyterian church.
Yes,
okay.
Knowing this.
That's okay.
And the female, she confessed, repented, engaged the process, and stayed on staff. It took 12, 18 months to finish the process where she was not necessarily paid the full amount and she was not actively practicing or leading worship, but she submitted to the fullness of process and stayed on staff, and then she chose to leave and go somewhere else, which made sense for her and the church. But she never lost her ordination. She never lost her access to the community because she submitted to the process. So who are you going to excommunicate first in 2024?
Hopefully no one. My smartest answer is some of the nominees for president of the country, not the congregation.
Oh my gosh, that's better. Okay, I was about to you have multiple people running for president.
No. We're all good.
Do you have third party candidates running for president of the temple?
That's actually a whole thing too. We're redoing our we're redoing all everything this year. We're revamping we're creating this kind of ethics code, this breed that I mentioned. We're also creating one specifically for board members that's less of a expectation of behavior and more of a this is what this job entails and you need to take it seriously. Because, I mean, this is a whole conversation we could have too, online or offline, is, you know, you and I work with a lot of volunteers, and that is interesting because, like, as volunteers, you know, they're not expected nor should be expected to do the kind of things that we are paid to do. But at the same time, like, people need to be held accountable to, you know, responding to emails and if they say they're going to do something and what if they don't do it and all that. But sometimes I think in nonprofits, we look for people on the board and kind of the extreme thing is, oh, it's nothing. It's just a meeting a month. And it's like, no, that's why I love what you said. You have to participate greatly in the work. I'm going to use your words, in the work and worship of our congregation. You have to have an ear to the ground. You have to be involved. It's not just being a body to cast a vote that you might not know anything about because you're not participating. And so we're creating this list of, this is what being on the board means in terms of all those things. And we're redoing we're after it's been 12 years, we're revising our constitution. So all these things play into it a little bit.
See, we as an individual congregation that is a member of a national denomination, we have local bylaws, policies, procedures, but all of those are subservient to the denominational constitution. And we can make no policy, procedure, way of doing something that is in conflict with our higher constitution. So I wonder if you have something like that in Reform Judaism.
Not really, because every congregation really, so let me put it this way. The centralized body, the Union for Reform Judaism, is not a governing body. It is an organizational one, and there are, I'm trying to think of how to put it. The best way I could think of it right now is just, it's not a governing body.
Yeah, you did it.
You could edit out me saying the same thing 15 times. Every congregation kind of decides on its own. And, you know, there are kind of norms and best practices that, you know, we talk to one another. But there are...
That would drive me crazy. I could not do that.
Yeah, you would hate that.
No. I need somebody smarter than me who has done this 1,000 times to have written down what they learned. And then our elders and leaders. So here's the last little bit, Todd. You're trying to figure out where the excommunication comes, where a person with legal power to voice and vote inside a community loses it. So it's the leaders that decide if members are or are not included. And our Constitution defines that. But if I did not have a fully detailed process, and it was on each community individually to define that process, kind of like Rabbi Eric's talking about for his Reform Judaism congregation, I would worry that local power brokers would finagle the rules to keep power themselves and would use it against wise, spirit-filled dissenters and prophets. And in the grand scheme of Judaism, the last thing you want to do is silence the beautiful words of a prophet. Nobody likes to hear them. Everybody's afraid when they talk. It challenges everything that you think is true about what's happening right now and why it should happen. But dadgummit, the prophets were right. Like a third of the friggin' Tanakh is prophets who were begging the majority to do it differently, see it differently, think differently. And I worry that our policies and procedures and excommunication manuals are designed to silence prophets. So the Presbyterian Church does everything it can to never give those in power too much power, and to always make the minority, to give them a way to be reheard and reheard and reheard before there is a harsh decision like removal from office or removal from the community.
Yes. Well said. Well said. Well, speaking of, Joel, I actually have a call in a few minutes about, well, not this very thing, but the breed that I keep talking about, which, yeah, the most egregious punishment would be, you know, again, God forbid, kicking someone out. But Todd, thank you for your question. And, you know, others, feel free to write in things that are on your mind, things that are bothering you, things that you've always wanted to ask a reverend and a rabbi about. And thanks for tuning in. And thank you, Joel.
You bet, buddy. And to all our listeners out there, keep it real. Thank you for joining us on the Religion Podcast today, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion. I'm Reverend Joel Talbert, and on behalf of Rabbi Eric Linder and all the Religion fans out there, we thank you for being with us today and invite you to send us any feedback or suggestions or topic ideas to religionpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep it real.